Das ist super. Ich bin total froh, dass so viele Menschen hierher gefunden haben. Das ist ja nun auch ein versteckter Ort. Es ist total schön, dass ihr alle da seid. Wir freuen uns sehr. Und ja, also herzlich willkommen, Lori Penny. Sehr schön, dass du heute Abend da bist. Unterstützung haben wir, beziehungsweise durch den Abend führt uns die Christine Kochschmiede, ebenfalls Autorin und Literaturagentin aus Leipzig. Die zwei kennen sich auch schon aus einer Veranstaltung im letzten Jahr. Kurz zum Ablauf. Lori wird einen Teil aus einer Geschichte lesen, in Englisch. Es wird so sein, dass die Christine das im Nachhinein etwas zusammenfasst. Und dann wird es ins Gespräch gehen. Dafür möchten wir einfach mehr Raum haben, weil ja auch die Sachbücher zuvor einfach total interessant sind. Und ich denke, dass die meisten Menschen doch auch aufgrund dieser Themen heute Abend hier sind. Habt keine Angst, stellt die Fragen einfach auf Deutsch. Die Christine wird das dann dolmetschen sozusagen während der Moderation. Dann würde ich jetzt einfach das Wort übergeben an dich, Christine. Sehr schön, dass ihr da seid.
Ich möchte meine Rolle heute Abend tatsächlich, willkommen alle, die es hergefunden haben, darauf beschränken, nur dann einzugreifen, wenn es Verständigungsschwierigkeiten gibt. Ich weiß nicht, wie gut euer aller Englisch ist. Wir versuchen das jetzt mal auf Englisch durchzuziehen, damit Lori, we'll try to do it completely in English, so you don't have to guess what we are talking about.
That would be good. I wanted to say thank you so much for putting up with me not being able to speak very much German. I understand it's a huge privilege to just be able to speak English and not a second language, so I really, really super appreciate that. I don't take it lightly. But if there's questions, that's okay to ask in German, right? And we'll try to translate.
Yeah, I'll have a short question. Ich weiß, wie schwer es manchmal fällt, da ein Handzeichen zu geben. Wenn aber jemand sagt, ich hätte gerne doch starke deutsche Übersetzung immer so zwischendrin, was sie gesagt hat, ich fände es auch sehr schade, wenn verloren geht und jemand nur aus Befindlichkeit sich da nicht traut. Also dann Handzeichen, dann machen wir nochmal eine Pause und geben ein bisschen mehr Übersetzung. So I'm willing to jump in with a...
Yay!
Anyway,
superhero.
So Sabina already announced that you're going to start with a little reading.
Yeah.
And then I'll start with asking the questions I got here.
Yay!
And it's like 9 months exactly that we met last time in Leipzig, yeah. And we talked about unspeakable things, which was basically facts. And tonight is the night for fiction, and we'll talk about that. But first, maybe we'll just let you. To your welcoming part
thank
and
you.
The reading part.
Thank you. The reason I'm reading off my phone is these stories are not actually published in English yet, not in a book format, because for various publishing reasons that they came out first in German, so I don't actually have the... I could try to read it in German and that would be hilarious, but that would be a different kind of evening in which you just all laugh at me, which I'm fine with, but you know. This is from a story which in English is called Your Origins May Be Recorded. It's about an angel who keeps falling in love with human beings. Take off my glasses so I can see the tiny screen. They tell you not to fall for human beings because they always die. For me, that's part of it. That's their beauty and their tragedy. Everything is always rotting, puckering, and falling apart under your hands, and you claw at them with your kisses to slow the tug of time, but you can't. The panic in their eyes when they reach the age, when they realize that yes, it's happening to them too. The way they swallow their breath at the point of orgasm. I can't get enough. Some of us are perfectly happy counting dust motes in sunlight or recording the little lives of the luminous creatures at the bottom of the ocean trenches who live and die and drift to the seafloor and know nothing but darkness. Not me. Loving humans is what got me demoted. A long time ago, Before the current system, when there were far fewer of them, it was our job to walk among men and women and all the other human creatures and teach them things they needed to know. Writing and calculus and basic food hygiene. We were allowed to give real advice back then, and we taught them a lot. But they taught us things too. They taught us what it is to fear death and nourish hope. They taught us about pleasure and passion and love. Love more than anything. I've always been drawn to the ones who burn with it, the ones who take their tiny lives in trembling hands and try to wring out all the juices before it's too late. I love fucking human men. I love loving them too, though if I'm honest, the fucking is quite a significant part of it. Nothing is ever just sex. I loved a scientist once in Babylon, in the land between the two rivers. His beard was slight and his eyes were black and fronded with long, long lashes, and it was the 8th century after they killed the Nazarene. And he found me in a decorative jar in the market, where a witch whose son I had seduced kept me prisoner for a decade. He took me home and broke the glass, and out I blossomed, fully formed and heavy-breasted, and he rushed for his notebooks. He was tortured by the impulse to understand everything, a fatal condition in human beings. He was full of rage at his own ignorance, and the more he eked out through his art and philosophy and mathematics, which in those days were kind of the same thing, the more he discovered that he did not know, and the more that knowledge consumed him. I loved him for that, and he resented me. Even in our bed, he resented me. His fingertips would outline my contours as if I was drawn on manuscript, searching for the secret of my substance. It hurt him to love me because I was a door to the wisdom of eons that he couldn't unlock. I knew the names of all the stars and I wouldn't tell them to him. I couldn't. It would drive him mad. And he would end up wandering the streets with the beggars and the crazed soothsayers. He told me there were worse places to end up. He longed to know the names of the stars, the true names that they only tell each other, how they were born, the exact latitude of this or that red giant. I told him that I had walked on a star once and it was nothing special. After that, he didn't fuck me for a week. He liked me in feathers, though. One morning I found out that he had plucked out all the phyloplumes on my left-hand side and was dissolving them in acid, trying to determine what I was made of. So, I took him walking on a star. He didn't like it as much as he thought he would. Somewhere around the middle of the 18th century, I decided I should give up the tragic poets and the doomed revolutionaries, and if I couldn't abstain completely, at least try and settle down with someone relatively normal. And so, I married a country pastor. He was surprised when I showed up in his study with my shining eyes, naked as the day I was never born. I thought we would at least have some shared interests. But he was one of those men of faith who looks away from the altar when he speaks to his sermons, avoiding the eyes of an unwelcome house guest. We were married in the springtime. He preferred me in my woman's clothes, white and perfect, as the shepherdesses in the pastoral paintings he would not allow in the house. And he was good to me, in his way. He was gentle and never beat me. He would make love to me gingerly between the sheets, thrusting blindly in the dark, trying to touch as little of my body as possible. He said that was God's way. I tried to tell him that the God I knew was fire and passion and cared not at all about how humans chose to fuck. In the mornings, I would boil him a single egg and watch him crack the shell with his short nails, not damaging the hard white jelly at all, leaving a pure and perfect oval so sinless that he sometimes couldn't bear to bite into it. I thought it wouldn't matter that I wasn't in love with him, but it did. Oh. One night, I came to him in my gown. So many layers in those days, especially in bed. I made my husband lie on top of the coverlet and lit the oil lamp. Then I took everything off, every stitch. He watched me while I stepped out of my gown, my night stays, dirty white lace dropping on the floor, the bloomers, the ribbons in my hair. And then I kept going. I took off my skin and hung it on a nail behind the door. I peeled away layers of flesh and bone until I stood there in my true form, burning and spinning, the rush in my ears so fierce I could hardly hear my husband scream. Then I left him. I hear he ended in a madhouse. There are worse places.
Thank you very much.
Sure, it's creepy.
Of course, I'm not going to translate your literature immediately now, like Sabine promised, because it has been beautifully translated.
Yeah,
and whoever wants to read it in German, it's available over there. Over there? Somewhere over there. But the original title, which I like much better than the German title I think is Kleine Gnaden.
Mm-hmm.
And the original title, Your Orisons,
yeah,
may be recorded, Ihre Gebete könnten mitgeschnitten werden. So that is something usually in service calls, when mm-hmm. you call the service team, they tell you that before, right?
Cool,
so
maybe
I like
recorded.
That idea.
Yeah.
And in that story, you have another sentence or quote which I wanted to start in with, so I'll quote that quickly. Huh. There it is. Human beings are confused. That's where we, being the angels, come in. Humans are confused about wants and needs, always on their knees begging for things they want rather than asking for things they need. And I would suggest that this is something all your writing, or at least the writing I read mm-hmm. so far, also the Unspeakable Things talk about. So would you agree that this is one of the core ideas, the confusion of us?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Well, look, I think desire is always political. Definitely, definitely. And sometimes the way that we are politically managed is by people telling us to want things that we might not necessarily need. I mean, this is the root of capitalism, it's the root of contemporary romance and so many other things. But actually, this story is kind of there's a little joke involved in it, because I was writing this story, it's kind of a little bit about various love affairs I've kind of had. And I had a new crush while I was writing it, and we were arguing about the way to write a story, and they said to me, look, the way to write a story is to set up a conflict between what the character wants and what the character needs. So this is like a traditional way to write a short story in fiction classes. So I kind of put that line in, and it repeats throughout the story, just because I was flirting with somebody I really fancied. Basically, that's why. So I don't want to pretend it's all more profound than it is, when it's basically just me trying to come onto somebody through fiction.
It's kind of neat to put it that way. Relationships I kind of had that time.
Sort of had.
So from the laughing, I can tell that people did understand. So I don't know. Also ganz offensichtlich war meine Frage, ging ein bisschen am Kern vorbei, weil es eigentlich eher so eine selbstreferenzielles Laurie Penny macht sich ein bisschen lustig über Fiction-Writing-Anleitungen war. Es braucht unbedingt einen Charakter, der zwischen seinen Bedürfnissen und seinen Wünschen hin und her gerissen ist. Und das hat sie aufgegriffen, weil es eben um die verschiedenen derzeit stattfindenden Affären und Beziehungen auch ging. But that brings me to the next point, the universe of reversed rules. Mm-hmm. I would want to call your compilation of short stories.
Yeah.
And let me start maybe with a non-fiction, 9 months ago. We talked about Unspeakable Things, and you were all into facts and statistics, but also we were talking about counter-narratives and how mm-hmm. necessary they were. And reading your short stories, I wondered how, from a non-literary theoretical point of view, how we could talk about the issues in there.
Yeah.
And I found people kept describing it as science fiction, and I thought, I ain't not seeing no science fiction there. I saw the universe of reversed rules.
Yeah, well, that's what science fiction is. Come on, Sarah. I mean, look, I'm a super, super, super nerd. So, which is a secret that's not very well kept. and like some of the, there's bits in that. If you're a nerd, I don't know how many people here are nerds, or maybe in secret. There are little references right the way through. Like there's a story about goblins or kobolds in German, and there's so much Dungeons and Dragons references in there. But it works if you don't know that. But if you do, you'll be like, oh yeah, that's from D&D Series 5, which is kind of what I like. And it's what I enjoy. So, but I think science fiction is particularly political, and that's one of the reasons I try and write it, partly because, you know, I'm used to, at least for people to see, I turn out a lot of non-fiction, and there it's, you know, it's hard to get away from the politics then in my personal writing life with fiction. And like in science fiction, even if you're, and in fantasy and in horror, anything that involves a different world, it will always be political because, basically, look, if you believe in your heart of hearts that capitalism is the ultimate destiny of humankind and that's how the world gets better and that's how the future will look, then you're going to write one kind of story. And if you don't, you're going to write another kind of story. And that's, it comes out naturally. And this is why, I mean, I read a lot of contemporary science fiction, and I think this is where the most interesting ideas in fiction are happening at the moment. But there is a real kind of move to bring science fiction and so-called proper literature into the same universe. And a lot of writers like Margaret Atwood, and who have been writing science fiction for a long time, but they say, oh no, this is not science fiction, this is literature, it's different. Now science fiction is fashionable. They say, no, I write science fiction, always have, total nerd. It's like there's a lot of nerd shaming that goes on, so I want to move away from that if I can. Sorry if you have to translate. I don't know if you're translating, but that was a rant. I apologize.
Whenever people are laughing, I take it they're not laughing for embarrassment of having not understood, okay, or laughing because they understood. So, oops.
That was your water.
It's just
I'm
water.
Sorry.
It's just water.
Yeah, again. So, okay, now, whoops, I stepped into the, how do you say that, Fettnäpfchen. I stepped into the Fettnäpfchen. So, like, whoa, it's not science fiction, it's political, isn't
no,
it?
No,
it's like,
sorry, oh, sorry.
It's just the same. What I was trying to say, maybe, that even if you're not into the goblin and magicians mm-hmm. of whatever world, it felt like, oh, it's not science fiction, it's mirroring.
Yeah.
It's like, she puts up sceneries and times and sceneries for her stories where I don't feel like somebody's taking me to the moon or to mm-hmm. some technicalities, but I can see society as it is, and as we've been talking about it before, seen from the eyes of somebody. So it's like, yeah, this is how they work, how they behave. It's like, yeah, they're talking about us, right?
Yeah. Well, science fiction is always about the present day, always. And horror is also always about the present day. There are a couple of stories in there which are just about witches. And I've got a real witch thing going on at the moment. I love stories about witches because I recently reread Silvia Federici, and now I'm all into witches and the politics of witches. But anyway, there is so much, you read science fiction or fantasy and it's always a commentary on the now, and particularly stuff that's meant to scare us or meant to show us a future world. Like zombie fiction, right? There's not a zombie story in here, but this is the classic example. Like we are overrun, pun intended, with zombie stories right now. The Walking Dead, so many movies, there's books coming out. Zombies are like a thing. They've been a thing for 5 or 10 years. There's been this resurgence of zombie stories. And when zombie stories first started to be told in pop culture in the 50s, 60s, it was about fear of the masses. It was associated sometimes with the civil rights movement, sometimes with fear of a popular protest, because this is the horror of the working class in some ways. It's the shambling masses and you can't reason with them, and they're not very bright, but there are loads of them, and they just keep coming and they keep coming, and all you can do is shoot them in the head. And this is what zombie stories are about. It's a very simple metaphor. But one of the things I was talking with some friends the other day, because have you ever asked yourself or had that conversation with friends like, what would you do in a zombie apocalypse, right? Like, people always think about, what would you do in the zombie apocalypse? And the obvious answer for almost everyone is, you would eat brains, because you'd be a zombie. I mean, statistically speaking, like, if we're thinking about how to survive the zombie apocalypse, we should be thinking about how to turn the zombie apocalypse around and make sure the zombies win, because we're gonna be zombies, realistically speaking. That's the kind of socialist zombie narrative thing I've got going. It's so, I'm really sorry. You keep asking me questions and my nerd, my inner nerd comes out. I'm meant to be all professional and ooh, literature, but like.
No, if I manage in getting the zombie, your inner nerd out, I'm feeding it, so I'm getting
sugar. Don't feed it brains.
No, you mentioned the zombie, and I am living in a zombie apocalypse.
Are
you? With three kids, so.
Oh, yeah, you're French.
But basically, since you mentioned the zombies, which are not present in your book yet, maybe the next, I will mention again back to the reversed rules thing, which I liked very much. So now, where's my paper here? You do have inmates, jailed in inmates, off a jail, detention center, whatever you call it. And your inmates are in the power of the door knobs. It's not the wards, it's the inmates. You have victims of murder employing their murderers or applying for being murdered. You have murderers reflecting on working conditions and why maybe a single mother would apply for being murdered because working conditions are really tough.
Yeah.
So you're hiding, or you're not even hiding, your old feminist issues,
feminist,
even in your
stuff.
Zombie, non-zombie fiction, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's...
That was not a question that you're going to answer anyway.
Okay. I can. Well, there are lots of... I noticed when I was looking through the collection is that there's loads of stories about bureaucracy in some way and about how people deal with the state on a day-to-day level. And partly that's because... I mean, I write a lot about feminism, but I also write about loads of social issues, particularly in the UK. And I've been writing a lot about the attacks on welfare and people trying to deal with the welfare state. And it's really, really hard to get across in nonfiction and just in an article the daily trauma of trying to deal with a system that's against you and trying to deal the horror of bureaucracy, the nightmare of it. And that's kind of... I found it easier to write stories about people who were experiencing that rather than just to say, I mean, I must have written 20, 25 articles in the last couple of years about this, just to say again and again how hard this is. You have to like put yourself in someone's body and experience it. So that's what I think fiction can do.
Putting yourself in someone's body to experience I'm jumping back to something. Actually, I want to start with what I slipped away. Do you know the club we're in here? It's called Kalif Storch.
No.
So it is called Kalif Storch, meaning it's Kalif is Kalif, Storch being stork. And it's a fairy tale. Do you know the fairy tale of Kalif Storch?
No, can you tell us?
Yes. So you do have this Kalif and his wazir going to a market, buying some magic powder they swallow to be able to understand the language of animals. They become storks. And there's a rule, and it says you cannot laugh while you've swallowed the powder and while you're a stork. What do? Of course, they break the law.
Yeah.
And then they get to stay storks because they forget the magic spell word, which makes them turn back to humans. And the magic spell word is mutabor, which is Latin, means I shall be transformed. So that should have been more storking question. Do you think we, as a society, may have forgotten the magic spell word mutabor, how to get transformed back to...
That's really awesome. That's an awesome metaphor. Like, I don't know how I can really follow that with an answer because that's a really cool idea. But yeah, it's metamorphosis stories. There are a couple of sort of body-changing stories in this, and I'm writing more of them. And I think, yeah, the history of stories about transformation is long and interesting, particularly stories about women changing into things. If you read back through Ovid, the Metamorphosis, and various fairy tales that I know, they're all about shapeshifters and what you can transform into, and I think there is a very basic longing there to be someone you're not. But I've always read those stories as kind of about queerness, and kind of sort of about transness, but that's just me and my personal reading. I don't know if that's just me having an interesting idea from the interesting idea that you had. That's not necessarily an answer. I'm kind of distracted by your brain at the moment. Sorry.
Isn't it about like throwing ideas at each other?
Yeah, yeah.
Getting something out of it?
That's cool. I want to write that down. Maybe favorite story about
But basically, actually, you got much deeper into it than in another way than I... the question was intended, because when we talk about counter-narratives last year, yep. 9 months ago, yep. when we were still getting pregnant with each other or something like that.
It's so weird. Thank you so much.
It was like, how we know, you especially, we are able to analyze and describe so many structures of the system. And it was like, well, we gotta find counter-narratives yep. to tell them to the young people, yep. young girls, young boys, confused persons. Mm-hmm. And now I'm coming back to one of your stories concretely, maybe mm-hmm. that helps. Hush.
Yeah.
Hush, little baby, isn't yeah. that like, be mm-hmm. quiet, calm down. So, it's a substance in the story, yeah. hush,
it's a drug.
Pill, it's a drug. So, and so the protagonist says, that's what hush is like, what being mm-hmm. on it is like. Omission. People call them happy pills, but that's not right. They don't make you happy, just less likely to freak out and break down every day.
Yeah.
Same question, like the ones I'm trying to put mm-hmm. as a red line. Is that forgetting Mutabor, swallowing hush pills, and functioning and being the Duracell bunny, going on batteries, going on and on and on?
Well, part of that story is an attempt to talk about antidepressants and to talk about various addictions in kind of a subtle way. Because I don't know if anyone's had, and I'm sure because of the statistics, there's many people in this audience who've had experience with depression, with anxiety, mental health problems, and medication. And there seems to be like, there's different ways of dealing with it, and you'll often hear people, particularly people who have a liberal or libertarian streak, say, well, this is all a con by the government, and you know, you can't take these drugs because they're meant to, you know, make you into sheep. Wake up, sheeple. And I think actually my understanding of, I actually started out in journalism as a mental health journalist, and writing for a publication for people with mental health difficulties about daily life. And people's experiences of depression and antidepressants are a lot more subtle and complicated than that. So I kind of wanted to talk about that and talk about how medication or addictions or whatever it is you use to chill yourself down can function as a response to trauma. And that can be political too. I'm really, really interested in all the kinds of work and writing I do right now and how people deal with trauma and people's responses to trauma, whether that's personal or political trauma. How do you deal with an overwhelmingly shit situation? How do you deal with the horrors of real life politics without breaking down? And that's a little bit what that story is about. It's about, and the main character is going through a withdrawal from antidepressants and talking about dealing with complicated feelings. So, yeah, that's what that's about.
That's what I like, no matter how much one, or me in this case, tends to talk seemingly only about the stories, it always gets you back, and that's what I wanted it to be, to talk about the implications of the political implications or the industrial capitalist implications of what makes people react in a seemingly individual way.
Yeah.
It seems to be an individual problem whether you are depressed, whether you mm-hmm. are traumatized, whatever. So you won't let us get away with that.
Oh, well, look, I mean, one of the things about fiction is that, like, I can tell you what I think it's about, but with fiction I'm not as much concerned if that everybody thinks the same as me, because that's not really the right way to write fiction. If I'm writing an article, I want you to think what I think. You know, there's no room for doubt. This is what I think, and you should, like, at least be able to understand that. But in fiction, it's messier, it's longer and more complicated, and there's complicated individual lives, and there's a bit more freedom. So there's all kinds of different interpretations. And I also think you lose something. I don't mean to be pretentious, but I think you lose something if you're like, this is what it's about. I mean, earlier we talked about science fiction being political by its nature, and I think one of the reasons that, yeah, I'm not trying to be dogmatic and make people think a certain thing and open their eyes through reading all this stuff. This is the reason I write about these things is because this is the kind of thing I'm thinking about all the time, right? This is the story that I write, and I'm constantly thinking about feminism and industrial capitalism. I mean, that's why that stuff happens in these stories. If somebody is constantly thinking about ponies, they'll write a lot of horse stories. That's one of the reasons this happens, right? It's just the inside of my brain. There's also werewolves and witches and goblins and murderers and all the other kind of weird stuff that happens in my brain that I'm not allowed to write about.
You should have published at a fantasy publisher.
I did.
So Nautilus as the utopian fantasy publisher.
Yeah. It's so wonderful. They're so good. Yeah, Nautilus, yeah, I love them.
Go by their stores empty.
Yeah.
You say when you're writing an article, you want people to think like you do. So you have this article about laziness and you called for a revolution of, and you've been asked about it a billion and zillion times, but what I found interesting. There we have non-lazy Laurie Penny living in contradiction to her own claims, of course, and even addressing that. So, and then you have that story, How to Eat Your Feelings. And there, I found another little quote I'm going to compromise you with now. If I could take a bite of your heart, it would taste of nothing at all. There are so many ways to fail this test. I know every way to pass, but I can't pass forever. And it feels like, we're talking about a situation where a highly intelligent being is reflecting about an exam.
Taking exams at school.
Yeah, right. And but as hopefully from the quote is to be told or could already be understood is that she has a problem with knowing how to deal so well. And I would blame you for knowing all about passing and getting through, but basically what maybe a necessity is not to pass anymore, but to go on a...
That's really, really hard and personal and awesome.
If you want to think about it, I'll open the room for
we
other
We can do questions, but no, seriously, there's a lot of... that story is actually quite a lot, me talking about my family and my childhood and my experience of, like, always getting really good marks in exams, and that was my entire life, was being, like, the clever girl at school who always got the top grades and was always very good. And I still, in some ways, there's always that tension with me writing about, you know, revolution and pushing against stereotypes and trying to have this kind of alternative life, writing about alternative things. But I am aware I still push myself a lot. Like, I'm on so much coffee right now to be able to be here. Like, you would not believe the caffeine I have consumed in the past 24 hours. To be able to do this tour and talk to you guys. And I'm also trying to finish two books by the middle of next month and do a full-time job whilst being on tour. Oh, and I'm judging a book prize, so I have to read 20 novels in the next month. So that's what I'm trying to do. And I don't think it's good, but I'm constantly working against my own overwork tendencies. So... I read fiction to escape, if that helps.
Plus, you're even being honest about it because you're admitting it. Can't you at least deny or something?
No, but that's the trick. It's the trick. It's like, oh no, I'm admitting it, so it must be fine. Hands shaking from caffeine.
But since you just mentioned talking to the audience, I mean, I don't want to have the monopoly here. So, come on, it's your one and only chance to ask Laurie Penny the questions you always
wanted
to.
You can come back next week.
Here, now, tonight. We can go on, but I would offer at least a bike. Wenn jemand sich einmischen möchte in unsere Geplauder hier, dann würden wir das jetzt eröffnen, ansonsten machen wir weiter. No, not yet.
Go on. Come on, help us out here.
Oh, I got more papers here.
Yeah, sure.
Ah, okay, well, they're all still thinking about their questions, maybe? No?
Have a think.
No. More of How to Eat Your Feelings, but maybe I'll let you summarize How to Eat Your Feelings first for a little bit because I throw the quotations at you.
Yeah, so the story is about, that's the one that has D&D goblins in it, which I'm kind of happy about. but it was me trying to write about the constant pressure, particularly within immigrant families, and I'm a third generation immigrant in the UK, to be, you know, to be highly achieving and education and the experience of the school system, and it's set with this character on the day of the final exam. And the experience of taking those tests. I'm not quite as familiar with the education system in Germany, and if how many exams do you guys have to take in school? Lots? Lots, I'm getting people nodding for lots, yeah, okay. And it's really, I mean, I must have taken hundreds of them at school, like in the years. But it's a, again, it's like an attempt to talk about that whole experience and the trauma of that, whilst also putting some fun cannibal goblins in there to make it like a bit more fun. I'm always trying to be entertaining at the same time as talking about the hard stuff. I think that's the key. So yeah, that's what it's about, if you wanna. I don't want to spoil everything. I want to read the book. Come on. Oh, there's a guy who has a question there. The microphone for him?
I could just yell at him. So you said you were originally a journalist.
Yeah.
What made you transition to a writer, and do you feel like you could achieve more by being a writer, or like things weren't working out as a journalist to get your message or what you wanted to do, and so being a writer accomplishes more, or?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, like, in the, it's only really in Germany that I'm known mainly as a person who writes books. I still think of writing books as this kind of little thing that I do on the side that nobody really knows about, which is why my schedule is scary.
Don't
no, don't tell anyone. I mean, in the UK, I'm mostly known as a journalist. I'm a full-time columnist at a magazine, and there's a, but yeah, there's stuff. I find books harder because I have a really short attention span and like I want to, yeah, it's like I find it much easier to sit down and produce 3,000 words than I do to produce a long book over the course of many months, and I'm trying to do more of that precisely because I find that challenging, because I've got that kind of, you know, auto-Taylorist masochistic drive, and I want to make things hard for myself, so. Yeah. Anybody else? Go on.
Before, I'll jump back to the question. Oh, okay. How to eat your feelings, the story. Mm-hmm. Because you get that the protagonist trying to comfort her friend how to
yes.
You could pass through the door,
yes.
Right? That has green lights and red lights, and the red mm-hmm. goes like beep, 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 you can't enter. She said, like, the teachers say that all you need to walk through the gate is confidence.
Yeah.
A real sense of your own specialness.
Yeah.
And it's not clear whether the teachers are lying to the kids or to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And a week ago at the Leipzig Book Fair, I attended a reading of Verbrecher Verlag and was talking about new strategies for the left and
yeah.
against right-wing mm-hmm. tendencies. And so one person from the audience asked, so what would you say the public school system, our teachers are supposed to teach kids?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's delegating to teachers sentences like this.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, actually this is really, like you kind of got what I was trying to say there again, because I mean, maybe I'm not as subtle as I thought I was, I don't know. I think I'm a really subtle, amazing writer, but clearly it's just all out there. Do you see what I'm trying to say about politics? So part of this is, I got a scholarship to a very, very posh school in Britain. I went to a really posh, we would call it a public school, but actually it's a private school. One of the things, like one of the big differences is not what they teach you, but what they teach you to expect. Is a class expectation thing. And this idea that if you basically just walk into places like you own them and you expect people to treat you with decency and respect, and then they do, it's like magic. But in order to, you can't, it's hard to fake that. In order to have that confidence, you also need, you know, a sense of security and financial stability, and often it's harder for women because they're taught, and harder for people of colour and queer people because they're taught to be somebody other than they are. And there's this huge dialogue about confidence right now, particularly within, I read a very interesting article lately about, you know, loving yourself and self-worth. And there's this huge movement, particularly on online, Instagram, everything. It's all about, you know, your life can be better if you just love yourself a little bit more and you're just a little bit more confident. And that's how you are meant to kind of overcome all the awful things about political reality. And you're meant to, just by the power of will and by the power of confidence and self-belief, be able to overcome all these obstacles. And of course, that's nonsense, because political reality does break in. But I think countering those narratives is kind of important. But again, like, that's a fairy tale people tell themselves. Sometimes it's a useful fairy tale. Sometimes tricking yourself into believing that confidence is all that all that's needed, that can kind of magically work. And particularly on the left in Britain, I'm not sure. I'm becoming more familiar with the German left, as it turns out. But yeah, somebody's read Facebook lately. But I do kind of wish the left would kind of learn to have fun and like itself a little bit more. But you can't. It's a really difficult thing to say, because then that ignores political reality. I don't know if I'm making sense here. I'm trying to think through as I'm going, but there's also a lot of stuff in this book and other things I'm writing about how the left relates to itself and how we can take care of each other better. So, and maybe stay tuned for that. I don't know.
When you say the claim of confidence or self-esteem or the claiming of things without giving ideas or guidances or rules or recipes or help or assistance, is that like a hashtagization of values? Ooh, oh, the light goes off there. No.
And the doors lock.
Uh-oh. No, because in Unspeakable Things, you talk about so many young people being confused by the ambivalence of what is claimed and asked of them and offered to them by society, by capitalism, by all the shiny stuff. And what they see, what those tell them, talk to them about self-confidence and career and esteem, whatever, just can't stand up to it themselves. I mean, they see a living lie. They're surrounded by living lies, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's what I think it's really, really hard, right? And that's why the conversation about this self-confidence thing is important, because on the one hand, you're being told that you have to just work on yourself and make yourself a better person and work harder and be prettier and be nicer and be more confident and love yourself, and then you'll get all the things that society promises to you. But that's doubly traumatic, because when that doesn't happen, you're meant to blame yourself. If when things go wrong, when there's, you know, massive unemployment and you can't get the job, then you're meant to blame yourself and think, well, I didn't get this because I didn't believe in myself enough, and, you know, I wasn't working hard enough, and it's my fault. And it's very isolating. We get isolated within our own depression and our own kind of our own fear, and that's kind of, yeah, I mean, that's my opinion. It's not necessarily meant to be in this book, but it's what I'm writing about that more in my other journalist life, so. Come on, somebody must have questions.
Maybe
we should have planted some.
Maybe it's too comforting today. Maybe since you just made a claim for more humor and more self or irony within, and you explicitly mentioned the left.
Yeah.
So how would you subsume, if I would want to consider myself part of the left, I would say, I do have humor. What do you mean?
Oh God! Well, the left sometimes doesn't know how to have enough fun and take itself less seriously, which is kind of understandable, because, like, our ideas are all we have on the left. We don't have, like, this sense of entitlement and power, and it must be us because we deserve to be in power. Ideas and solidarity is what brings us together, and it's very, very serious. And I've sometimes I face problems with this when I'm trying to write articles gently mocking, not just the left, but other things in life. People have been like, why are you trying to make comedy out of this? It should be pure theory. But I don't really like pure theory. I read it because it's useful to read it, but it's not fun to me. I think the phrase attributed to Emma Goldman is, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. And I think that still holds true, although I don't actually like dance parties very much. And so somebody I'm very close to gave me a T-shirt that said, if I have to go to dance parties, it's not my revolution. Which is one of my favorite things. I prefer to stay home with the internet and read. So, yeah.
That would be a perfect quote to go on Twitter. I didn't count the numbers if it would fit in 142, yep. But maybe that leads to the next question. I got another card here where I wasn't even sure whether it would fit in here or not. Mm-hmm. But I read an article about Katrin Wessels. Are you familiar with the name? Mm-hmm. She's a social media manager at the Spiegel. Mm-hmm. And after Brussels, mm-hmm. she started a hashtag called Auf die Liebe, on love. Mm-hmm. And that was highly discussed, how that would, like having a toast on love in the face of all the horror, the terror, mm-hmm. the controversies, the... And so she was asked by Wired magazine mm-hmm. How good social media are... qualified as a medium of solidarity. Mm-hmm. So the question that belongs to that would be, how qualified are social media as a medium of revolution, and how qualified are social media, or illegible, or whatever, as a media of discourse, and even of getting into challenging discussions. And I'm really talking about Twitter.
We're talking about Twitter.
I mean, Facebook allows a little longer, but basically Twitter.
I mean, look, this is probably not the right day to ask me that, because I've had some problems with the internet in the past few days from various sites, and but the quote, and it's not my quote, I can't remember the name of the guy, but the famous quote about technology is, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral, and... excuse me, I've got a bit of a throaty cough. Particularly, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, during the London riots and during the kind of upsurge of feminism online, I was being asked, is the internet good or bad? Just is the internet good or bad? Is it good or bad for young people? Is it good or bad for women? And I think the answer to that is yes, it's good or bad. Like, you know, the internet is many, many things. It's neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. Because if you look at, you know, what's happened with Brussels and in the aftermath of Brussels, there has been huge, huge hatred, huge upsurge of Islamophobia and disgusting things being said and rumours being spread. And it's been completely, completely horrible, right? And this happened after the Paris attacks as well. But... the internet also lets wonderful things happen. There was a hashtag, and again, you know, we can take the piss out of hashtags all you like, but it's an interesting way of showing solidarity. There was in America, this was a few months ago now, a Muslim mother in America posted something on Facebook saying that her daughter, who was 8 years old, had seen and read about Donald Trump. And she was so frightened that Donald Trump or people, you know, or Donald Trump's guys were going to come and get her and deport her, that the little girl had packed a suitcase. And she said, like, soldiers will come for me. And she was terrified. And the mum posted up a picture and said, look, I hate that this has happened in the US. And then another mother who was a soldier, a white American soldier, posted up a picture because she saw this, and the picture said, and she wrote underneath a text that said, I will protect you. And whatever, this is leaving out the discussion about the military, right? That's a whole other discussion. But this soldier woman said, I also think it's disgusting. And you can tell your little girl that if soldiers come and if Donald Trump comes to take her away, then I will be there and I'll protect her. And this is a picture of me, and this is the woman who's going to stand there and protect you. And then, I'm sorry, I'm actually getting emotional about this. These are like loads of US military people started joining in the hashtag I'll protect you and promising to protect this little girl and all the other little boys and girls in America, like soldiers posting pictures of themselves in their army uniforms and very American, you know, but saying like, I'll be there and I'll stop the fascists and I'll protect you. And that's kind of, it's so you can have that solidarity thing as well. The internet is wonderful for creating community very, very fast. You see that as, I mean, in my own experience, being a queer person, a genderqueer person, I would not have found my community without the internet. And I think we have to, it's important to remember that positive side when horrible things are happening, I think, I hope.
How come that story scares me? I mean, first of all, I don't even think I would ever post a picture of one of my kids being scared.
I don't know what the picture was, actually.
Well, even if it was only the suitcase and the quote. But I see this as a simplification. It feels like I got an army of, not from your side, but an army of protection-willing soldiers behind me, willing to protect a little child, by the way. So it's like, I'm scared. What I wanted to start with that question, basically that leads into it, is... I wasn't into internet bashing. I was just into the dynamics that certain conflicts can take. And yes, you were exposed. Many people in here may have been exposed to that, which makes people rather talk about each other and take sides and find allies and seek for allies. And in the end, something has not deflated. What's the opposite of deflate?
Inflated. Exploded.
Exploded, yeah. Let's call it exploded. Mm-hmm. And you cannot catch it back like feathers that have been spread again. Mm. And there is no rational talking about the real causes and the things that have been said and done possible anymore.
Yeah. Well, the Twitter in particular is not a good place for facts. Right, it's a place to get information out very fast and to break news and share stories very fast. It's not a good place, with some exceptions, for on the ground confirming, reporting things that happened, and rumors can spread very quickly. And within journalism, there is this dialogue at the moment within, as you know, journalists and news organizations are panicking that they're going to be replaced by Twitter and replaced by Facebook, and I think it's not something to panic over, partly because these things work in harmony. I mean, a newspaper is never going to be able to be the first person, the first with a story, very rarely now. You'll have to have a big investigative piece. Breaking news is something that the internet can do better, it just can. Twitter can do breaking news better, it can do live updates better, but it's important to kind of remember that there is a lot of heat and noise and not a lot of light sometimes on Twitter, and there is a, you know, there's, you can, sometimes you have to move into a more reflective place and slow down. And I guess that, back to your question, that's one of the reasons that I'm trying to write longer things, because in my columnist journalist life, it's all about fast reaction and fast pieces and hot takes, and sometimes it's more worthwhile, particularly as I get a bit older and I get more reflective. I am getting older.
When will that be?
Yes. Hey!
Getting older.
Not reflective. I'm 30 this year. It's amazing. Oh, this lady has a question.
Yeah, you talked about your activity as an economist.
You said you worked for a magazine on mental health. How much do you see yourself as perpetuating the self-help industry? Do you see it as a problem? Do you feel you're standing apart in this certain category? And how much do you think it influences your point of view in seeing a lot of problems but no solution?
Well, look, this is really interesting, right? Thanks. So I'm kind of, in some ways, Unsagbara Dinga, Unspeakable Things, is meant to be an anti-self-help book. It's meant to be, I mean, particularly the introduction, I'm trying to say, no, the problems aren't just with you. You know, you can't make everything better just by fixing yourself and making yourself a more perfect person. Let's talk about a kind of feminism and a kind of politics which sees broader problems. But yeah, it is sometimes really depressing to say that, because then that means that solutions have to be structural and they have to be bigger. And the only solutions I've found so far are in challenging narratives and creating cultural change, which is not something you can do alone. Like the attractive thing about the, not just the self-help industry, but the logic of self-help, is it's very empowering. It gives you a lot of power to be able to think that if I just change myself, that's within my control, and then I can, then things will be better. Actually, some parts of left politics and feminist politics are about acknowledging the things that are outside our control, the problems that can't just be fixed by buying a new dress or getting a better work-life balance. And that's kind of why I try to crack jokes and tell stories and be entertaining and funny, because otherwise it would be so depressing all the time. So yeah, that's kind of why I'm trying to be a bit lighthearted about all this, because otherwise it's horrible. And I read a lot of science fiction to cheer me up. So, anybody else? Go on. Comments. Anything. Help me out here, guys.
Because otherwise I will.
Oh, thank you, person running around with the microphone.
I have a question concerning the feminism today, because feminism seems to be very fancy at the moment.
Does?
Yeah, I have this impression. Oh, I hope I get there. Well, I can say this in English, okay. Because I have the impression that nearly every month there's a new magazine for women coming out at the station, for example. And every time in the editorial, there's feminism, a very big theme. And even people like Taylor Swift call themselves feminists.
Yes.
I would like to know what you think about this fancy fashion feminism
that's going on
at the moment.
All right, well, okay, I've got two separate thoughts about this, right? One is the personal childish feeling. So I was into feminism. I just got nerdily into feminism when I was really, really young, right? I was like 11 or 12. I started reading feminist books. So now that everyone's a feminist, I want to be like, I was a pink-haired feminist before it was cool. Everyone's a pink-haired feminist. I'm like a hipster feminist, basically. I'm like, I was doing this, but it's like when your favorite band suddenly gets really popular and everyone likes them. Basically, it's that kind of childish, no, it's my thing, you can't have it. Even though it's about like worldwide revolution and everyone should have it, I'm like, no, it's my thing, can't have it. But in general, I think I don't have so much of a problem with fashion feminism. Fashion feminism is a really good phrase, honestly. I actually really like Taylor Swift, I'm not gonna lie, I do. Look, she produces and writes most of her own music. She went into this big fight with Apple with Spotify, thank you. You know, she's really on it for somebody who's only in her mid-20s, and some of her songs she writes about love are really kind of awesome and empowering, and like, I don't mind if she wants to call herself a feminist. I'm not really into judging people on how good a feminist they are. People often ask me about Beyoncé and whether I think Beyoncé is a good feminist or not, and firstly, I think it's kind of worrying that people are asking me, like, you know, sort of posh white feminist, what I think of like this upstart woman, person of color, who is like having the daring to be a feminist too, despite the fact that she sometimes performs in her underwear. You know, I think it's kind of telling of how we, even within feminism, people seek to pit women against each other, right? But at the end of the day, even if you think, and some feminists do, and some people on the left do, that you can't be a real feminist until you've read all the theory and you've read your Simone de Beauvoir and your Marxism and you've really understood, and then you can, you know, graduate to the Jedi League of feminism and, you know, have your whatever, your kind of maybe your round lightsaber, because we don't want any phallic shaped lightsabers. Yeah, so I don't think that's true, because at the end of the day, when you got that Beyoncé's song Flawless, which I think is a great song, she drops almost like a 30-second segment from a feminist speech by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie in the middle of it. And at the end of the day, you know, millions of people, including really young kids, girls and boys, and will have heard that and heard a basic definition of feminism, started to talk about it. And I don't think there's any way that can not be a good thing, as long as we don't, like, let it be entirely co-opted by advertising. I think some... what I find really amusing, actually... sorry, I've got lots of thoughts on this. So advertising has noticed that feminism is a thing now, and they've noticed that they can't just do the same old sexist stuff they have before, and sometimes they get it right, but sometimes they get it so wrong, and it's delicious kind of watching them fumbling around for what the right way to talk to women is and sell things to women without the old strategy of just tell women that they're horrible and disgusting and then you should buy this product. And it's really interesting watching that transformation. I find it amusing. Anyway, anyone else? Go on, let me rant about something. Oh, yeah. Oh, hang on, there's someone at the back with a microphone, then maybe they can bring it to you.
In deinem Buch Unsagbare Dinge sagst du ja, dass die sogenannte Krise der Männlichkeit eigentlich eine Krise des Kapitalismus ist. Kannst du noch mal kurz erklären, warum Männlichkeitsbilder und Kapitalismus zusammenhängen und warum, wenn wir Kapitalismus überwinden wollen, wir auch eine Diskussion über Männlichkeit brauchen?
Okay, he's addressing how in Unspeakable Things you are describing how the crisis of masculinity or of male masculinity should better be described or symbolizes a crisis of capitalism. And if you could maybe explore a little more on that.
Thank you so much. By the way, it's always, I mean, it's only in Germany that I get questions where people have actually read the book. So it's really brilliant. So thank you very much. Especially, and no offense, like when a guy stands up at the back of the audience and is like, I'm going to ask a question now, and it starts with men this, I'm like, oh no, what's it going to be? And it's like, oh, amazing, you've actually read the book and have something to say about it. That's amazing. So I'm going to draw a line under my delight and shock. But look, the crisis... There's been a lot of discussion, particularly in the past 5 years, about this so-called crisis in masculinity and how men can't be real men anymore because of probably women, I don't know. Like, because they're all now living in their parents' basements and they can't get real jobs, and then they're being emasculated by feminism and it's all awful. But actually, if you look at through history at various periods of economic crisis, what you find is that this discussion comes up again and again and again. Like, you have people, in the 1920s, where there was the economic crisis, there were people writing articles about how men can't be real men. And it's because often economic trauma and the assault on identity that is periods of crisis in capitalism is expressed through gender. So, and men experience this too, although it's much harder for men to talk about, because the one thing men aren't allowed to talk about and be experts about is their gender, or anyone's gender. So men experience this, and they're told that they're experiencing this as an attack on their masculinity, and that's a way of turning the rage and frustration that is natural away from being directed at employers and the state and the rich, and into, you know, self-hatred and shame and also anger at women. And that's what's definitely what's happening in the US and the UK, more and more here. There is you know, real, there's a real backlash and men are turning their frustrated energies against women. You see this online all the time, and this is, you know, just because that's where it comes from doesn't make it okay. It doesn't mean that, oh, you know, really it's all about capitalism, so we should understand and we should let them off. It's still disgusting and we should resist it, but it's important to understand the roots of it nevertheless. So, yeah, thank you. That was really cool. Did you have a question? Lady in the... Oh, this lady here was first, actually, but...
Ich wollte noch sagen, zu diesem Feminismus, der immer so gesagt hat, es geht immer um Feminismus und das ist gerade so wichtig und interessant. Ich mag das sehr an ihrem Buch, dass sie Feminismus so, also so global sieht, dass viel Feminismus sein muss, dass es dafür nicht nur einen Weg und eine Definition gibt. Und das finde ich total wichtig bei ihr. Weil ganz Feministen immer so absolut sprechen und sagen, die Frau ist das Wichtigste und die dürfen jetzt auf gar keinen Fall mehr Abwasch machen und der Mann, der muss parat stehen und der muss das und das und das machen. Und das finde ich total wichtig, dass wir das auch so ein bisschen revolutionieren, dass Feminismus ja auf jeden Fall, aber auch in einer gewissen Art und Weise, dass jeder Mensch für sich, wie es schon gesagt hat, wie Taylor Swift zum Beispiel, auch feministisch sein darf und auch sein kann, auch wenn sie vielleicht so auftritt, wie sie das tut. Also dass jeder als individuelle Person einfach die Chance haben, uns auszuleben, vielleicht auch Taylor Swift zu sein und trotzdem feministisch sein zu dürfen. Das finde ich voll wichtig.
Is this a question about Taylor Swift?
Ja.
No. Okay.
Ich versuche es mal wiederzugeben. Danke. So there probably was one term you did understand, well, two you did understand, which maybe Taylor Swift and feminism. And she was backing up in a way what we had in the question before, what she particularly likes about your writing. And I don't know, the book, which book? Unspeakable, Unsagbare Dinge?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in Unspeakable Things, is that you seem to open up the one feminism thing mm-hmm. and inviting even Taylor Swift, or giving the option that feminism does not only mean that women are told you cannot do the dishes anymore, otherwise you're not a feminist, but that we can be Taylor Swift and do the dishes and yet still be feminist, and that she really likes that. Is das ungefähr so wiedergegeben?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, look, I mean, I'm not trying to say that everything is feminist. Everything, even oppression is feminist. Like, there have to be limits. But I'm really... I don't like the trend, and it's often not driven by women, it's driven by kind of male editors trying to understand and set up stories about feminism, this trend of making modern feminism about just judging who is the best feminist, which is kind of like what is, rather than judging who's the best woman, who's the best dressed, and who's the thinnest and the prettiest, now we're judging who's the best feminist. Like, great, something else to judge ourselves about and feel awful. I mean, the amount of times recently within, like, my friendship group and people I know, I've heard people saying, oh, I'm doing this, and oh, I'm a bad feminist because I'm not doing this, and, you know, my boyfriend and this, and I can't, you know, I can't, and I'm a bad feminist because I like to wear makeup, and that makes me a bad feminist. And I'm a bad feminist because I like to look pretty. And it's just, it's not about judging. I don't think feminism is not something about, it's not about judging yourself. It's a tool to help you analyze your life choices and change the world. It's not a set of, Kathleen Moran, the British feminist, says very succinctly, feminism is not a set of rules, it's a set of tools. And I really, really like that, and I wish I'd thought of it first. you were waiting at the back, I think. Okay. Oh no, somebody give it. Okay.
Hello.
Hey.
I think I speak at first in English and then when I
Okay.
Did you hear something about regretting motherhood?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about or I don't know how to explain for the others. There was a young soldier.
You can say German.
Yes, thank you. es gab eine Soziologin, die eine Doktorarbeit über Regretting Motherhood geschrieben hat. Und es ging darum, sie hat 20 Frauen befragt, 20 Mütter. Alle haben damit geantwortet, dass sie im Nachhinein, wenn sie über ihre Mutterschaft nachdenken, es bereuen, Mutter geworden zu sein, aber dennoch ihre Kinder lieben. Und meine Frage an Laurie ist, glaubst du, dass es eher ein Problem, ein gesellschaftliches Problem ist, dass diese Frauen sich nicht genügend unterstützt gefühlt haben? Oder und vor allem lieber ihr arbeiten gehen oder ihrer Arbeit nachgehen wollen, beziehungsweise kann man nicht auch beides, also Mutter sein und arbeiten, oder also das genau, das war jetzt.
She's referring to that sociologist, and it's really hard to pronounce, study, talking to 20 mothers who expressed their regret of motherhood. Mm-hmm. And the question she has is, would you rather refer to that, or would you agree maybe, that this would be a social problem of these mothers not being sufficiently assisted by society in their motherhood? Or, I don't know, oder? Nein, das war, yeah.
Yeah, look, I think it was, I've read more about that study, and there have been, sorry, I can't look at you because the light's in my eyes, but I've read about that study, and there have been other interesting articles published within the English-speaking press, and I think it's very, very brave when people come forward to say this, because however, whatever problems you have, you're not supposed to talk about having any bad feelings or regrets about having a child. If you're a woman, you can say it if you're a guy. You can leave your family if you're a guy. You can walk away. One of the reasons that people regret motherhood, of course, is because, precisely because the work of raising children and the work of domestic labor is meant to be something that women do on their own for free, and support is becoming less and less as we become isolated within our communities. And I think one of the ways to get more support and make sure this happens and change those situations is to have this conversation and to say that it is hard and it's not always easy. And even if you love your kids, it can be a really, really difficult decision and one you might regret. And when we talk about women's choices, this is the one choice that we don't want women to actually be able to make. I was in conversation with a couple of friends of mine around my age, late 20s, early 30s, who have been trying to get sterilized because they don't ever want kids, and they want they want the doctors to be able to perform this operation one of my friends, who's a really strong feminist, went to her doctor and said, "I want you to raise the forest," which I was like, okay. And in both cases, they found it extremely hard because the doctors were saying to them, "Well, have you thought about this? You know, you might regret this someday." But nobody, when a woman turns up pregnant, says to her, "Well, have you really thought about this? This is a big decision that you can't take back." And it is a big decision you can't take back. I mean, what kind of bigger, more unalterable decision can you make than having a child? But the fear is that if women really have these choices and really think about it, then we might maybe stop having babies. And then maybe society would be in big, big trouble because we'd notice how hard we've made it for women and people would start actually making other decisions about their lives. So, yeah, it's hugely important. And I think I didn't address this enough in Unspeakable Things, partly because I wasn't yet at the stage of my life where people are asking me all the time when I'm going to have a baby. I am now. I'm at that stage now. So maybe in the next book this will be a whole big bit of it. I don't know. So
the huge problems will not arise if people read your fictional stories and learn from your character.
How to make a robot baby. Yeah, there's a robot baby in it. It's fun. You can turn it on and off.
There was somebody in the... Yes, there's two more.
I have a question on capitalism.
Yeah.
You once wrote somewhere that capitalism is just a narrative, mm-hmm. and we have to change the narrative,
yeah.
and then it all becomes, like, good, and we all get friends or something. I just get the feeling that it's not that easy, somehow, and I would really... Or maybe I got it wrong, but I really like to ask you to comment on that.
All right, so yeah, it's not... Part of the job of journalism and writing nonfiction is to try and boil it down and say it in snappy sentences. Of course, it's harder than that. But capitalism and neoliberalism is a story in the way that religion is a story, in the way that romance and the story about men and women and what they do is a story. It's a big, powerful story that takes a very long time to turn around. But changing the story, I believe in that narrative is hugely important to our politics. And if we change, I also really love that people are taking selfies right now. So I'm really distractible. I'm like, squirrel, selfies. Narrative is important. Okay, we're back on that. Capitalism is kind of a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale that controls all of our lives. But like every other political narrative, it relies on people believing it to be true. The idea of growth, the idea that society only progresses if we pour money into this system which creates growth within the finance industry, in order for that to continue to be the case, people have to believe in it. The stock market is a fairy tale. It's a, you know, the countries can economically fall apart because of people's lack of confidence in certain markets. It's all about the stories we tell ourselves, and that can be incredibly, incredibly powerful. So yeah, it is a really simple way of saying it, but one of the reasons that counter-narratives are so important and telling ourselves that things can be different is useful and valid, even when it seems silly, is because that's kind of the only way that things change, particularly at times of huge political turmoil like this. Yeah, that's my answer. I hope it's okay. Not tweet length.
Yeah, but maybe that's the point, that you're not saying that narrative and counter-narratives can be reduced, no. Like the sentence, go be confident, go change capitalism. So yeah, it's exactly, it takes effort to go further than just telling kids be non-capitalist or be confident. It takes so much more, and people realize whether you are willing to go all the way or just give recipes, right?
Yeah.
To Twitter length.
Since it came up with the pop feminism and stuff, I thought about Germany and in general, actually, that there is a big backlash at feminism right now. And I don't have much connections to the UK, so I ask you how it is in the UK. And yeah, well, I don't think that feminism is really so up and coming, but since the people in power do not really like feminism, so maybe we can talk about that.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, well, there is a huge backlash in the UK as well, thank you. It's, and in the US. But I like to believe, and I think it's true, that one of the reasons that the backlash is happening is that we're actually making an impact. People wouldn't bother to attack women in the hordes that they are doing, and with the viciousness and the relentlessness that they are putting on this backlash, if they didn't have to take it seriously now. I mean, these kind of ideas are penetrating people's consciousness from now and a very young age because of the internet. People are reading and learning about feminist ideas in their teens, you know, before their teens, and that's actually really threatening to society on a basic level. And the reason there's a backlash is because it's genuinely fearful to a lot of people. I am not, in terms of the people in power, it depends what people you're talking about. If you're talking about men as a whole, yeah, I think there's a huge backlash on, and that's one of the reasons that it's happening, is because men as a whole are afraid. I've never been a person who believes that laws and the change of laws and what happens in the top ranks of politics is where I'm interested in changing culture. I think the really useful thing at the moment is that apart from some areas like abortion rights, and obviously now the situation of immigrants in Europe, a lot of the changes and a lot of the systemic changes that feminism is calling for are no longer purely on a legal basis, which is bad because we can't just go out there and say, change that law and make it better. It's not that simple. But on the other hand, it means that we don't have to sit around waiting for politicians and engaging with politicians. We can change culture on a more intimate, personal level. And so much of it is about that intimate level, which is political when you distribute it amongst millions of people. So that's kind of what gives me confidence. Maybe that's just me telling myself a story, but that's kind of what I do. So
you're in good company with Gramsci.
Yay!
Eine hätten wir noch. Ist da noch? Ja, da hinten.
Oh, it's right. Oh, hey.
Der Slavo Žižek hat jetzt ein neues Buch rausgebracht. Und da geht es ja auch schon um Flüchtlingsbewegung und er nutzt das, um geflüchteten muslimischen Männern ihre Unaufgeklärtheit anhand von ihrem Verhalten gegenüber Frauen und ihrem Standing zu Feminismus vorzuwerfen. Was hältst du von so einer Kritik und vor allem, dass jetzt in der Debatte, vor allem in der linken Debatte, die ersten Adressaten für Feminismus und Frauenrechte schon wieder Männer sind, insbesondere geflüchtete muslimische Männer und nicht geflüchtete muslimische Frauen?
Du stellst mich echt vor Herausforderungen, ich versuch's. Aber eine gute Frage, danke. Have you read Slavoj Žižek's last work? If not, the question works without having read it anyway. But Žižek, Moment, es ist Žižek selbst, der diese, ja. Žižek is addressing, or not even addressing, but reproaching male, Muslim, Arab refugees for their backwards stand towards women, towards feminism, for their atavistic standing towards females or towards the role of a woman. So he's asking, what do you think, first of all, that the first addressee of feminist critique being addressed by a man and being directed towards males, refugee males, and not towards the ones exposed to this treatment or behavior.
Okay.
I hope that covers it.
But, well, look, this is a question on a couple of levels. Look, firstly, I kind of see Slavoj Žižek as like the Father Christmas of the left, right? Eventually you sort of stop believing that he's real, and then you stop like listening to what, I mean, I went through my Žižek phase, honestly, but like then I saw him. I once met him on the street coming out of the BBC. It was so bizarre, and I was like, can I take a selfie with you, Žižek? And he was like, yeah, sure. So I've got that on my Instagram for some reason. He looked so bored. Look, Slavoj Žižek is not the only person to think that the real way to do feminism is to attack Muslims and to attack Muslim men in particular. And I think this is a narrative to resist within European culture in particular right now, because feminism is, whilst obviously we have a huge problem with sexual violence in Europe. We already did before this refugee crisis, and we should never minimize that. The use of feminist ideas to attack minorities and to divide communities is really, really troubling right now. And nobody seems to be talking to refugee and Muslim women about what they really think and what they really want. I feel like their voices should be the first in terms of the critique that's being drawn. And there are actually a lot of Muslim feminists and Arab feminists who have been writing for years about this stuff, and yet nobody's been listening to them because, you know, they're not white European men. On the other hand, I do think it's really, really important that men in general call each other out on this stuff, because, I mean, sadly, because of the way we are raised and because of the sexist ideas in society, men are more likely to listen to other guys when they tell them that doing a certain thing is bad. And I think on a micro level, that's one way that men can be really useful to and within feminism. It's how you behave when women are not in the room, and how you deal with other men's sexism, and whether you choose to challenge it and whether you choose to stay silent, that's the kind of test of being a decent ally. It would be nice if that didn't involve just focusing on Islamophobia, but I mean, yeah, talking to other men is very, very important. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's one good thing that Slavoj Žižek has done. Hooray! I like what he wrote about toilets. I thought that was funny. Maybe we have one more, if anybody has one more.
If not, you're going to share the toilet story. Oh, okay, there's another one.
Just to get you right, men are can only be allies, they can't be feminists themselves.
Oh, no, I didn't say that. No. I think men can find it more difficult to do feminism because it involves them starting out by listening and starting out by taking a back seat within the movement and listening to women's views and opinions first. And this is something that men are not raised to do, and that can be actually, it can be really difficult. I'm not taking the piss, it really can. But yeah, I think it's great when men call themselves feminists, partly because it's a really challenging term for other men to hear. Even the word feminist is a tool, it's a litmus test, it's about how people react to feminism. So yeah, I'm always really, I mean, I don't see it as my job to, like I've said before, to judge who can and can't be a feminist anyway. But I don't think Donald Trump can be a feminist, you know, there's some limits, but yeah, I think it's great when men call themselves feminists. I think it's brave. I only date men who call themselves feminists, personally. So, I mean, if that's relevant to anyone, I don't know. Maybe that's it. Are we done? I don't know.
Anyone who wants to start a printing press for labels calling out feminists, males can acquire to date Lord Penny.
Yeah, join form a queue. Yeah, or not, because I'm really busy.
Maybe I can add a last thing, that calling yourself a feminist is one thing, but I think it's even harder to behave and act like one and be consequent and consistent about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think feminism is less of an identity than a process. And I've said this before in books and interviews, but I think it's, at the end of the day, it's not what you call yourself that counts. It's what you, feminism is a set of tools. It's what you do with it that counts. But sometimes the label can be effective in itself and a challenge in itself. That's why I think it's still important. Yeah.
That sounds like a damn good last word. The only tool you'll get to be handed now will be a pencil or a pen.
Yeah, feminist sticker.
No, to sign your book if anybody wants to buy it. It's out there.
You don't have to. You can buy it.
Plus, there's only two copies of Unspeakable Things. So whoever wants to get that, go run.
Zombies.
Thank you,
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.